I want to open with two quotations and then share a bit of commentary on those quotations and then make sure that we have sufficient time for some discussion. The first quotation is from Cotton Mather. It's from a book that he wrote in 1702, Magnalia Christi Americana. Cotton Mather was a Puritan father, and he had this to say. Religion brought forth prosperity, and then the daughter destroyed the mother. Religion brought forth prosperity, and then the daughter destroyed the mother. Lewis Mumford, writing in 1956, had this to say. All but one of the seven deadly sins, namely sloth, was transformed into a positive virtue. Greed, avarice, envy, gluttony, luxury, and pride were the driving forces of the new economy. Goals and ends capable of working an inner transformation were obsolete. Mechanical expansion itself had become the supreme goal. Mumford is saying that the economy that had forged such a strong industrial base in this nation had made virtues of all of the seven deadly sins except sloth. And so he says, greed, avarice, envy, gluttony, luxury, and pride were the driving forces of the new economy. By new economy, the reference is to capitalism, which received its most, received its classical statement in Adam Smith's book, The Wealth of Nations, which coincidentally was published the very year that the nation was born, 1776. So that's the reference to the new economy. Now, I want to talk a little bit about the Protestant ethic and what has happened to it. Between the time of Mather making that comment that religion brought forth prosperity and then the daughter destroyed the mother, and Lewis Mumford's writings in 1956, where he said all of the seven deadly sins that Mather was so worried about were the actual motors of the new economy itself. Samuel Adams of Boston, another early figure, had a vision for the coming new nation. When the American Revolution had run its course, Adams said, and we've put the harsh rule of the British to sea, then a new republic would emerge, and this republic would be on the order of what Adams called a Christian Sparta. Now, what did he mean by that? He said, in a new and bold start, the Americans would be a people made strong by discipline and frugality, and they would excel in the wise management of scarce goods. All of this would be nurtured by their faith, a Christianity which cultivated self-denial, and which rejected material indulgence. So Adam said the new nation will be a Christian Sparta because the faith of the new nation encourages self-denial and a foregoing of sensual and material pleasures. And this new Sparta then would live a life of the wise manage an economy of would have an economy of the wise management of scarce goods. Well, you see what's happened to Samuel Adams' vision. It's been abandoned wholesale. And so has the version of American Christianity that Adams espoused. Now, why? Let's talk about the Protestant ethic and its origins, because the Protestant ethic was probably the most influential force of a religious nature in the new economy, the capitalism that this nation is famous for. Early in this century, a German sociologist by the name of Max Weber published a very important book. It's called The Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism. I put it on the board here. In that book, Max Weber argued that the Reformation, especially its Calvinist strain, gave rise to a way of life that matched precisely the particular needs of early industrial society and early commercial society. Early commercial and early industrial society needed what? It needed a reasonable number of people who would work hard, would lead frugal lives, would save money, and all the while postpone the pleasures of leisure and would abhor habits of high consumption. They simply must work hard, save, lead frugal lives, and not be indulgent consumers. That's precisely what was needed. What for? Why? Because the new economy, capitalism, had to accumulate capital, had to accumulate finance for investment, had to build a strong industrial base. So you didn't want to be chewing it up as soon as it was you produced it by hard work. You had to postpone the high consumption. The ethic that you needed then to get capitalism started was an ethic where the cardinal virtues were hard work and frugality, and the major moral vices were idleness and material indulgence, or high consumption of goods and resources. Precisely that was the Protestant ethic. Virtues, hard work, and frugality, and self-denial. Vices, idleness, and consumption. The script of the Protestant ethic went something like this. It had a theological base. It was a religiously based economic ethic. Like this, then. Your arena to God is in your day-to-day life. This is what both Calvin and Luther taught in the Reformation. So glorify your Creator and your Judge in your workaday world. Faithful performance in your workaday world is your responsibility to a righteous, holy, and judging God. Do not indulge in sensual and material delights. Extravagant living is not godly. Discipline to self-denial is. This is more Calvin than Luther, if you know Luther. Luther has some good exceptions to all of this, but this is the Calvinist ethic. Idleness is an abomination. You may indeed accrue wealth as the outcome of hard work and disciplined living. If so, Calvin taught, regard that as a sign of God's favor. Yet the world is a harsh and it's a brutal place. So you may also, despite your hard work and frugal living, remain poor in material matters. If so, be assured that God will reward your ardent labors with an abundant life on the other side of death. Okay, that's sort of the script of the Protestant ethic. What I think is very noteworthy here is that in the Protestant ethic, prosperity is regarded as a sign of God's favor, like it is in a lot of the Old Testament materials. Poverty, however, as such, is not a sign of moral depravity. It isn't poverty, to live in poverty, is not a sign of moral failure in the original Protestant ethic. Idleness in the face of the opportunity to work is a sign of moral failure or moral depravity, but not poverty as such. One might work hard all one's life and still remain poor. Okay, there's a clear picture of the good life here, and it's a picture of the good life which informed much of early America, especially colonial Calvinism. It's this picture of giving glory to God in productive labor. The picture of the good life is one of productive labor, not meditation or not leisure. The good life is a life of productive labor. There's also a picture of the good person here. And the good person here is the responsible steward who is humble, grateful, and industrious. Now these were the moral models in a religious vision that had strong economic consequences in the New World. But something happened, as something always does. As the economy of capitalism became established and the industrial base expanded, as it did in this country, especially in the 19th century, then some changes occurred in the Protestant ethic, above all in America. For reasons of its own logic, this dynamic capitalism requires ever greater capital accumulation. By capital accumulation, I just mean more material resources, more financing. Capitalism is an expanding kind of economy. It always has to look for new markets. Dynamism requires that it have higher and higher levels of consumption. If an economy is in a capitalist economy and it's not growing, then it's not working. Now, as this transpired, this expanding capitalism in the 19th and 20th centuries, some elements of the Protestant ethic were retained, but some elements of the Protestant ethic were changed. What was retained was the enormously productive work ethic. After the Puritans had lost their hold on the religious consciousness of the country, their work ethic, in a secular form, still persisted. So I want to talk about three changes in the Protestant ethic then that came, mostly in the last century and then into this century. One, the frugal, simple lifestyle of deferred pleasures of the early Protestant ethic was abandoned wholesale. Especially in this century, in the prosperous decades that have followed World War II, we aren't even close to the Protestant ethic anymore. Number two, prosperity as such in the last century became a sign of divine favor and moral accomplishment. There were millions of Americans who agreed with Episcopal Bishop William Lawrence when he said, "Godliness is in league with riches." There was another clergyman in the last century that gave a sermon entitled, what was it, Acres of Diamonds. He gave that sermon something like 3,000 times, Acres of Diamonds, which established the principles of what was called the Gospel of Wealth. And the two principles of the Gospel of Wealth, which were perpetrated as in keeping with Christian faith, were these. One, that man, when he is strong, conquers nature. And two, and I'm quoting, that it is only to the man of morality that wealth comes. That was the Gospel of Wealth, and it retained the Protestant ethics work thrust, but said prosperity as such is a sign of God's favor and moral accomplishment. Okay, the third change in the Protestant ethic was that poverty as such, just the condition of living in poverty, and not simply idleness now, became the clear mark of moral depravity. Poor people were regarded as being failures by virtue of being poor. Henry Ward Beecher, perhaps the most famous American preacher of the 19th century, had this to say: "Looking comprehensively through city and town and village and country, the general truth will stand that no man in this great land suffers poverty unless it be more than his fault, unless it be his sin. There is enough and to spare thrice over, and if men have not enough, it is owing to their want of provident care and foresight and industry and frugality and wise saving. This is the general truth. So if you're poor, it's your sin that is exhibited there." Now that's the third change in the Protestant ethic. Now, with these three changes, then, abandonment of the frugal lifestyle in favor of consumption, secondly, prosperity as such a sign of moral accomplishment and divine favor, and third, poverty as such a sign of moral failure. With these three changes, Americans had fashioned an ethic which bordered on divine sanction for the prosperity of the rich and divine condemnation for the poverty of the poor, which is, interestingly enough, almost the reverse of the biblical perspective, in which God has special compassion and care for the poor, and the harshest words of judgment for the rich. So the Protestant ethic had, in effect then, been transformed into a Yankee work ethic and a Yankee wealth ethic. Now the title of this session is Ironic Pilgrimage, From Protestant Ethic to Yankee Work Ethic to Consumer Ethic. Why ironic? Is there a connection between the Protestant ethic and the kind of ethic of high consumption and hard work that we got out of the last century and into this century? I think there is a connection. And I want to read from John Wesley's journal. John Wesley founded, as you know, the Methodist movement in the British Isles, and he preached a kind of pietism that emphasized exactly the same virtues and vices as did Calvin with the Protestant ethic. So again, it was hard work and frugality, self-discipline and self-denial that were the virtues of the Christian life, and it was idleness and material and sensual indulgence that were the vices. But John Wesley saw a dilemma. And the dilemma was this: if people in fact work hard and are frugal, they will inevitably produce wealth. And if they produce wealth, it will undermine that very ethic that that was the dynamics for producing it. So Wesley writes this: "I fear, wherever riches have increased, the essence of true religion has decreased in the same proportion. Therefore, I do not see how it is possible in the nature of things for any revival of true religion to continue long. For religion must necessarily produce both industry and frugality, but these cannot but help produce riches. But as riches increase, so will pride, anger, and love of the world in all its branches. How then is it possible that Methodism, that is a religion of the heart, though it flourishes now as a green bay tree, should continue in this state? For the Methodists in every place grow diligent and frugal. Consequently, they increase in goods. Hence, they proportionally increase in pride and anger and the desire of the flesh, the desire of the eyes, and the pride of life. So although the form of religion remains, the spirit is swiftly vanishing away. Is there no way to prevent this continual decay of true religion? We ought not to prevent people from being diligent and frugal. We must exhort all Christians to gain all they can and to save all they can, that is, in effect, to grow rich." So Wesley says, we've got to preach true religion, namely industry and frugality, but it'll produce riches and that'll undermine the religion. So he says,
We must exhort all Christians to gain all they can and to save all they can, that is, in effect, to grow rich. And then he goes on with this famous advice, you should gain all you can and save all you can, give away all you can. But that admonition was utterly inadequate for stemming the kind of indulgence in riches that Wesley himself saw as the very fruit of true religion. Well, Wesley's true religion was, of course, not all religion. But it was the Protestantism in this country that one found in Calvinist New England, in Quaker Pennsylvania, in Methodist and Baptist frontier regions, and to some degree in Midwest immigrant Lutheranism. It was, in Max Weber's rather succinct phrases, the religious valuation or religious underwriting, sanction, of restless, continuous, systematic work in a worldly setting as the highest means to the good life and as the surest and most evident proof of genuine faith. So, and then Weber goes on. Now, when this playing down of consumption, not consuming lots of goods and services, when that is combined with this tremendous drive, tremendous economic dynamism, then the inevitable practical result is obvious, namely accumulation of capital compulsion, accumulation of capital through a compulsion to save. So, here's what I want to get at when I say it's ironic, this pilgrimage from the Protestant ethic. The Protestant ethic is a version of what in religious life one calls asceticism. Asceticism means a life of discipline, self-denial, frugality. What is ironic is that it's very difficult to see how what began in asceticism, Protestant ethic, would not end up in hedonism. Just as soon as a religious restraint was lifted on consumption. As soon as a Puritan religious universe was gone and you had no sense of being responsible to a judging, righteous God that demanded of you frugality and self-denial, as soon as that was gone, then this tremendous Puritan drive in economic life produced enormous wealth that it then had to consume. And, secondly, the capitalism that was the economy of this country itself required, for its own reasons, higher and higher levels of consumption. So what began in self-denial and asceticism in the Protestant ethic ends up in hedonism. That's why Hugh Hefner's Playboy, and now Playgirl as well, ironically, are just a couple generations removed from the Puritan consciousness, which was so anti-Playboy and Playgirl. The Puritan ethic plays into the economy that produces that kind of consumption that has oppressed toward that kind of hedonism. Or, put it this way, the irony is that what began in asceticism, self-denial, discipline, frugality, religiously based, ends up in hedonism. What began in simplicity ends up in luxury. The Protestant ethic helped generate a driving Yankee work ethic and Yankee wealth ethic that ends up in consumerism. I don't know what you're going to do with that, but that, I think, has been precisely the course of American capitalism. And that religious base is undercut by dynamics that it helped set in motion. Um, There are lots of other streams of influence as well. There's the kind of individualism that this country is famous for, and that individualism was given expression in the book that I mentioned by Adam Smith, The Wealth of Nations, published in 1776, where Adam Smith said that the individual acting in his or her own interest would do that which in the aggregate would also be in the interest of all. The invisible hand, which is Adam Smith's phrase, which was then given religious sanction and understood as God, the religious hand, the invisible hand would orchestrate life in such a way that individual self-interest in economic life would lead to that which served the common good. Now, put the Protestant ethic with its driving work ethic together with this kind of capitalist individualism, and you can see how you're on the trail for the kind of consumerism that we've got today, in which the whole world is viewed as a kind of storehouse for pursuing self-realization and self-fulfillment. Okay, capitalist individualism, the Protestant ethic, and I guess I would add quickly two more influences that get us from the Yankee work ethic to the consumerist ethic today. One of them is religious influence, and the other one is not. Again, this is a matter of irony. One does not think of pietism as a contributing force to the kind of consumerism that we're in, because the pietism that I grew up with and that you know was a pietism that played that down. But what pietism did was this. Maybe I should say, first of all, in just a sentence or two, what the religion of pietism is. Again, in John Wesley's terms, it is a matter of having one's heart strangely warmed. That was Wesley's phrase. Faith in the pietist tradition, which influences a lot of Lutheranism, a lot of Methodism, and a lot of the faith of Baptists. Pietism was a matter of personal experience and feeling. What mattered most was one's living relationship with a personal God. So the self and God, personal sin, experienced grace and forgiveness, and individual testimony were the hallmarks of pietism. We've got a revival of pietism right now in the so-called born-again movement. True religion for pietism has to do with the inner lives of people, not with institutions, not with society's major preoccupations, the nitty-gritty of politics or economic life. For pietism, religious life and political and economic life belong to two separate arenas, and faith has to do with an inner sphere of the self in the presence of a living personal God. Pietism's effect on the consumerist ethic was by way of a non-effect. That is to say, it simply said, that economic life, which was set in motion in large part by the Protestant ethic, simply is not a matter of religious faith or concern anymore. So, if you ask a lot of Christians today, what do faith and economics have to do with one another, you get silence. Or what do Christian values have to do with American economic the values? There will either be an easy identification or a simple not a reply. Okay, the other sphere or the other stream of influence is one that is a long word used by the sociologist, secularization. What does secularization mean? It's a name given to a particular social process that has occurred in all industrial nations. That process is one in which certain arenas of life have come to have rules of their own. They've come to be semi-autonomous, semi-detached from one another. So we say politics is politics, economics is economics, religion is religion, family life is family life. There are different rules of the game in each of these spheres, and they're relatively detached from one another. So you see, pietism and secularization reinforced one another. Pietism privatized religion, made it a matter of the inner self. Secularization, said religion, was a separate sphere, as was economic life and political life. So, again, the values of capitalist economics then, namely to emphasize hard work, production, and high consumption, could go on their own. And these various streams, pietism and secularization, only either positively or negatively pressed for that, or did not at least obstruct it. Okay. So we end up with an ethic of high consumption today, dictated in part by the values we hold, dictated in part by the requirements of the economy that the Protestant ethic did so much in forging. And you can see how far we've gotten from Samuel Adams' vision of the new nation as a Christian Sparta. Our life is anything but one which values Spartan values, and our Christianity is anything but one which emphasizes self-denial, discipline, and a rejection of sensual and material delights. I think, rather than finishing, I'll just quit. At Holden, we always end things on a semicolon. I'll just bow out on a graceful semicolon. And see what kind of comments you have, what kind of reaction you have, whether you think this is true, that we've gone from the Protestant ethic to a Yankee work and wealth ethic to a consumer's ethic. Whether you think the lines are as I've sketched them, namely that ironically the Protestant ethic helps set in motion the very dynamism that ends up in consumerism and that is so utterly in opposition to the Protestant ethic itself. Whether today is the time for looking again at the Protestant ethic. Some people say it's got a future, not just a past. Yeah, you were about to say something.
Well, about the United Methodist Church in Adams, and according to our senior pastor's preaching, it's not supposed to be true, because his whole preaching is that in all these fields, economics and social and every field you mentioned, God should be the head of it all. And his total preaching is, you don't just come here and have your religion on a Sunday. You carry that out with you
mm-hmm.
into your walk of life, no matter what it is,
mm-hmm.
into your kitchen, into your business, into your work of any type.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it is too true that it's not being carried out always, in the nation as a whole, and probably with a lot of people in every church. I think it's an immense temptation the way things have gone for people. One of the most immense temptations that they've had is ability to become rich and selfish and self-concerned.
Does your pastor preach on economic life? Does he advocate particular anything specifically with respect to the kind of Christian perspectives or values that ought to inform or guide economic life? Or the
no, except the Christian principles he preaches, the value of the Holy Spirit, ruling the life, but that it should be, it's a total thing that goes everywhere, that controls every aspect of your life. He is not one of these ministers who preaches on the economy of the country, really. It's all Bible-based, very, very close to the Bible. Mm-hmm. I was a Bert Nair Lutheran. My husband was a Lutheran. And he passed away. Well, I very much admire, but I can't see too much anything we'd have to argue about, really, between what I've seen at your church and all the time he was alive. We went to the Lutheran in the mornings, the children and I. I never joined because they required absolutely, this particular church anyway, it was Missouri Synod. I started to join, and I came across some bumps, which under Methodism, you wouldn't have to believe literally, just exactly every little thing. And I came to one main bump that I couldn't cross, and I told him what it was, and I said, well, I just can't join your church then. But I don't. The Missouri Synod, I understand, is very much more strict than the other Lutherans. I don't know.
Yeah.
But they're wonderful people in that church. But then, how much people do this is another question.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what we who feel that. Well, I suppose we go and listen and try. That is supposed to be our model.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Well, it really sounds in effect, however, to live out a faith consistent with what has been preached, we're between a rock and a hard place. Obviously, pietism didn't have its desired end. It also
often combined with the Protestant ethic. Yeah. That is, people in the pietist tradition, such as informed Lutheranism, often combined with the Yankee work ethic, and said that your piety showed its true face in the fact that God blessed you with these good things.
All of which moves very much away from the whole concept of grace. What it seems to me is that, maybe the kids in the 60s operated out of sheer frustration.
Mm.
To a large degree, which might have been a little anomalous in some cases, but they had mainline Protestant doctrine pumped in, and many of them gone confirmation and given all the right answers,
yeah,
without it ever affecting how do I live.
Mm.
And some enlightenment as to what the gospel really said, didn't add up for them.
Mm.
I keep thinking about this sociological institution theory. You begin with a great deal of enthusiasm at this point. You grow, you become solidified, you drop off. The question begins to be, why do we do it this way? And the reason, mm-hmm, the question is, why do we do it at all?
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't answer that question with some vitality, which brings you back to the beginning again, people just quit coming to church.
Mm-hmm.
Church has no meaning.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of the things you're saying, in a sense, point to why this happens, too, because there's so many inconsistencies between perhaps what is preached and yet not related to everybody's marketplace dilemmas. So that the preaching comes at a level up here, which is consistent with the Bible, but it never gets down to, so how does that affect your living? You know, how does that help you make hard choices? How does that help you choose an alternative lifestyle, even if nobody else did, and things like that? I don't think there are no easy, nice, neat, with all the ends tied up solutions to the dilemma that you pose.
Yeah, Carol.
If that irony that Leslie described is accurate, what's wrong with his solution, his slipping between the horns of the dilemma and saying that, well, then we should give away the money that would solve?
I guess my response is that the acquiring of the wealth was in large part because the work ethic, together with the capitalist order, institutionalized the economy. That is to say, it had its own dynamics, its own logic, its own set of institutions. And that explained in large part the enormous production. Okay? I mean, whether you held those religious values or not, if you worked in that economic system and you had at least a commitment to work, that was the outcome. It was an institutionalizing of the economic order. Now, Wesley's advice, which is gain all you can, save all you can, give away all you can, is not an institutional response. It's a voluntarist response. And I think a response that calls on people to voluntarily give of that which they've worked so hard at is not a response adequate to something the dynamics of which are institutionalized. It's a little bit the dilemma of all voluntary communities. At that point at which they want to see what they've acquired by their voluntarily choosing of the simple life become policy or catch on or, you know, for the rest of the environment around it, they have to go to the institutionalizing of it. They've got to go to laws or, you know, building an economic system, some form of public policy. And when you do that, then you're no longer doing this voluntarily. So, I mean, the reason I think that Wesley's answer was not an answer adequate to what caused the dilemma for him is that it was an answer which resided in people's voluntarily giving of their wealth, whereas the system was not one that voluntarily generated it. It institutionalized that generation of it. And so you had a phenomenon of all sorts of mass poverty in the cities, and the answer to that being the call to rich people to be philanthropists. That's the Wesley answer. I don't think that's an adequate answer. If the poverty has any connection with the system itself, you end up by perpetuating poverty and perpetuating philanthropists. Which is one reason why socialism arose from within capitalism and against it, and not as a separate system outside and apart from.
I don't think it's an adequate answer either, but I'm sure I can't solve the problem. But it seems to me the whole system has got completely out of hand.
Yeah.
And it's got to be changed, but just a little bit on me at this point. I wouldn't say that our contributions either are all voluntarily, because sometimes I think that the pressure is mighty terrific. But I also make another criticism of ours, and other churches. I think that some, I have seen occasions that some poorer beginning families who really could hardly make ends meet when you go to house personally, and they can't make ends meet for food, clothing, and shelter, they withdraw from the church. I could tell you a good many instances. And I think that's terrible. So there are a lot of things that have to be solved. But maybe capitalism has outgrown itself, but I think that unless something's done, I just feel personally that unless there's some change somewhere, whether we want to drift into socialism or something like that, we're going to anyway. Because history shows, in my opinion, that when the people get too much pressure, the poorer people, middle to lower economic status, then there's going to be a change. Because they'll just stand so much.
Marilyn? Was Wesley's call for people to give of their excess or of their substance? Because there's a radical difference if you're asking people to just give what they don't want to use for themselves or what they might not want to put into buying their wants.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you're asking them to live in accordance with their needs.
Yeah.
Because if it's sacrificial giving, it tends to subvert the system that even gives them their wealth. If it's giving of only of your excess, it does tend to reinforce the status quo or the method by which you get your more than adequate income. So one method of giving would put pressure upon the system to change, and one would probably help maintain it.
Depends upon the circumstances, but in answer to your question, Wesley's, in a sense, is excess, but his view of what people needed was so much lower than ours that he's expecting everybody to live with just enough, you know, and anything above that, meeting really basic needs of diet, clothing, shelter, and work. Anything above that is for him regarded as excess.
But
it still builds up the system. I mean, the Methodist movement in both Great Britain and in the United States was an influential movement in promoting the early capitalism. It was very helpful to it, so it was supportive of, I wouldn't call it a status quo, it was an emerging status quo. It was a dynamic new movement. Yeah, and it was supportive of that.
But his preaching was at the beginning, I believe, if I'm right, the beginning of industrialism, wasn't
yes.
it?
Well,
which is quite a different
yes.
thing, and the tremendous capital of, well, oppression in a way almost, and I probably never dreamed of that.
It was at the beginning, and the great dislocations that were true of early industrialism, early capitalist industrialism, were present in Great Britain at the time. So that you had large pockets of urban poverty. You had dismal conditions in the mining regions, and it was in this kind of setting that Wesley preached the Protestant combined with Pietist ethic. And there's a big debate on whether the Methodist movement saved Great Britain from a Marxist socialism. Because both of them had their roots in roughly the same period, responding to the awful conditions of early capitalism. No presence of child labor, restrictions, sweatshop conditions, just the whole mess that was in the early stages of the Industrial Revolution. I don't know where all this ends up. I mean, it's a burning question today, right now, what the economy requires, and if it's a major change that is required, or if capitalism can, as it has so often, transform itself. It may be a little hard to listen to, but it's so good that I want to read it. Max Weber, in the last paragraphs of The Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism, had this to say. Now, he's writing this 70 years ago. The Puritan wanted to work in a calling. We are forced to do so. For when asceticism was carried out of monastic cells into everyday life, that's what the Reformation did. It took the life of self-denial, frugality, discipline out of the monastic life, and the Catholic Church put it into everyday life. That's what Luther and Calvin preached. Okay. When asceticism was carried out of monastic cells into everyday life, it began to dominate worldly morality. It did its part in building the tremendous cosmos of the modern economic order. What we said. This order is now bound to the technical and economic conditions of machine production, which today determine the lives of all of the individuals who are born into this mechanism, not only those directly concerned with economic acquisition, with irresistible force. Perhaps it will so determine them until the last ton of fossilized coal is burnt. So Weber is saying, in answer, a little bit in answer to your question, Carol, everybody now is caught up in this system, and not just like the Puritan who could choose it as a calling, as a choice, okay? And maybe it'll determine their lives till the last ton of fossilized coal is burnt. In Baxter's view, this is an English, not Quaker, Puritan. The care for external goods should only lie on the shoulders of the saint like a light cloak, which can be thrown aside at any moment. Christians ought to be able to just say goodbye to their worldly goods. But fate decreed that the cloak should become an iron cage. Since asceticism undertook to remodel the world and to work out its ideals in the world, material goods have gained an increasing and finally an inexorable power over the lives of men as at no previous period in history. Now, if that was true in 1900, what would Weber say in 1980? Today, the spirit of religious asceticism, whether finally, who knows, has escaped from the cage. But victorious capitalism, since it rests on mechanical foundations, needs its support no longer. Doesn't need the religious undergirding at all any longer. The rosy blush of its laughing era, the Enlightenment, seems almost also to be irretrievably fading, and the idea of duty and one's calling, Protestant ethic, prowls about in our lives like the ghost of dead religious belief. People in economic life don't have a strong sense of duty, of one's calling. Where the fulfillment of the calling cannot directly be related to the highest spiritual and cultural values, or when, on the other hand, it need not be felt simply as economic compulsion, the individual generally abandons the attempt to justify it at all. In the field of its highest development in the United States, he's a German, the pursuit of wealth, stripped of its religious and ethical meaning, tends to become associated with purely mundane passions, which often actually give it the character of sport. Pursuit of wealth, stripped of its religious and ethical meanings, tends to become associated with mundane passions, which actually give it the character of sport. I have a good friend who sells real estate in Washington, D.C., who talks about it with all of the language of a game, the character of sport. Actually, sports, professional sports these days, look at the wealth involved. I mean, you just took it literally and not figuratively. Okay, 1900. No one knows who will live in this cage in the future, or whether at the end of this tremendous development entirely new prophets will arise, or there will be a great rebirth of old ideas and ideals, or if neither, mechanized petrification embellished with a sort of compulsive self-importance, simply individuals immersing themselves in material indulgence. A me generation. For of the last stage of this cultural development, it might well be truly said, specialists without spirit, sensualists without heart. This nullity imagines that it has attained a level of civilization never before achieved. Specialists without spirit. Technicians without spirit. All doing a little piece, but related to no religious and moral universe.